Okay, welcome to section. This, again, is meant to be very casual, an opportunity to ask questions, have hands be held a bit more when it comes to where to start, what to do, and so forth. Last week we looked at most of the code, dare say almost all of it, except for a couple of tidbits that were germane only to the DOM building code. The classes that were relevant to this DOM building code are relatively few. So here we have our MF directory, like you saw last week, and some of these classes we looked through, but just to pluck off one, notice that relevant to tonight's material is, for instance, this Node class. And again, we did everything in terms of classes, not interfaces and so forth, just to keep the MyFirst parser code relatively simple. Notice that inside of this class, first of all, which is abstract, so that's our way of enforcing that you can't actually instantiate a Node object, but rather only its descendants. Notice that it looks like we are storing children as a linked list. You do this in a number of different ways. We chose, for instance, this linked list structure. And if we scroll down a bit further here, notice that every node has a name, every node has a reference to a parent, every node has a value, and this particular node has a type, which we've just declared as a constant zero, and notice that we've declared elements to have a code of 1. Notice that we've also declared a constant for attributes and a constant for text nodes. So recall, we saw those tonight. There were these constants built into the node interface of JaxP. We stole some of those same constant names and put them similarly in our own node class. We have given you an implementation pretty much of this notion of adding a child, which is kind of nice because we're just using the notion of linked lists. So you add a child, you just call the linked lists function methods classes add method. And then what else is in here? The rest that's in here is pretty self-explanatory because most of the functions are one-liners for getting values, getting nodes, and so forth. But what's...
What do you mean by you may not modify? Is there no reason to, or is there something...
No, we simply... You may not modify it in the sense that no modifications are necessary to it, and in the interest of being able to standardize the tests of all the code, we keep all of this the same. So, and none of this code is to suggest that this is the way to do it or the best way, but it's often the best way to achieve the sort of focus that we wanted.
We could use it, right?
Oh, you absolutely will need to use it, yes.
We could write it ourselves.
Right, right. The goal was not to have you write everything, though, just some of the illustrative tidbits. So take a guess. If we open the element.java class, what kinds of stuff are we going to see in here? I mean, just guess what might be some keywords in this class. Sorry?
Documents.
But with the element class, specifically.
Constructor.
Okay, it's going to specifically be extending the node class that we just looked at.
And
the name and value. So we have a setter here, a constructor that allows you to instantiate a new element and set the element. And in short, I would defer to the Java doc for some more details on what these things do, but notice the element class does relatively little now. Returns its node type, and notice that you may modify this file. In fact, such will be necessary, because what are you doing in Project 1? Implementing, attribute supports. Unfortunately, there is no such support here just yet. And we're relatively loose on what you must do here because it allows for design opportunities. Just implement as you see fit in accordance with the spec. So in short, there's a number of classes we didn't look at last week, which probably not valuable to dwell on tonight since they're relatively boring, but attr, for instance, document, node, element, text, all of which are similar in spirit to what we just looked at. But the DOM builder code, which is this guy here, this is where your focus would be. So notice we have a bunch of description up here, and then we have some constraints up at the top, which I'll defer to. But notice what DOM Builder is. It's a content handler, ultimately. Right? It extends default handler, just so that we can take some shortcuts and not implement every darn method in the API. Notice that DOM Builder does support, just like the document builder does in the JaxP interface, the notion of getting the document, which returns a reference to itself. But notice there's a big old to-do down here. Because the goal, after all, per the spec, if you've read over Project 1, is to implement a content handler called DOM Builder that builds a DOM out of SACS events. And if you're still not quite sure on how to do that, think back actually to our sort of pictorial walkthrough tonight when we did that very brief PowerPoint animation where you had SACS event coming in and DOM being constructed. That is the visual that you need to implement. And so what kinds of methods, for instance, need to be here? Start element, characters, end element, start document, end document. You're going to need to implement at least those in order to build up in memory your own version of the DOM. And that should be relatively easy once you've, I think, gotten comfortable with the visuals we did tonight, and then, two, done the SACS part of this assignment, which will make this seem, I think, a little easier.
So we need to call SACS parser within this or
that? Nope, you never need to call SACS parser, because that, in fact, in tester.java, which we looked at most of last week, it has two test routines. Number one we talked about last week. Guess what number two does? Yeah. Test routine two is pretty similar to the DOM builder.java demo we did tonight, insofar as it instantiates one of your own parsers. It instantiates a DOM builder and then parses the document and then uses this stuff to actually serialize stuff back out. So these lines of code here, as the comments indicate, this is our way of serializing the document. So DOM Walker, which is the last file we need to glance at, is sort of a DOM-specific serializer. So we saw in tonight's document builder demo a standard serializer class you can use to just feed it a DOM and spit it all out. Well, we call that same notion a DOM Walker because it only works on DOMs. It's not an arbitrary serializer. And so what DOM Walker is going to do, and you can really only implement this well once you've implemented DOM Builder, is it is actually going to have a walk method, which is called in that test routine. First thing it does is it calls start document, then it calls visit, and notice what's going to happen here. And actually, let me go back here for just a moment into tester. In test routine 2, I'm sorry?
So the last step is going to call this one.
Correct. So notice that in test routine 2, what we have here is we instantiate a DOM builder, which we just looked at, in which itself is a content handler. Notice that when we parse the document, we pass to the parse routine that reference, just like we did in tonight's demo. We then retrieve the root of we retrieve the document node itself so that we have the very tip-top of the tree. And then in this code here, what we are actually doing is the following. We're calling our DOM Walker code, but passing him a reference, not only to the DOM that we want to traverse, but a reference to the thing we want to use to serialize. So you don't have to write all the new annoying code of writing an open bracket and then a name and then a quote and then a double quote, but what your DOM Walker code is going to do is actually recurse over your DOM. Because your implementation, unlike, for instance, the JAXP interface, might use your own clever approach to how you store children, how you store attributes, and so forth. And so you can't just pass your DOM to JAXP's serializer like we did with our first demo. Because what if you call your references different names? Silly little things like that. It's not going to be able to traverse it if we don't have the same exact API as expected. And so what happens in DOM Walker is we essentially have a visit routine that calls the serializer start document handler. So you don't want to have to deal with all the pretty printing and the aesthetics of standard output. So you just say that serializer, you deal with whatever you do when I call start document. Then you are going to essentially recurse on all the nodes in this tree. When you're done recursing, then you're going to call that guy's end document routine. Let him deal with whatever he does at the end of the document. And so the interesting line, this middle one, is this routine. And what this has to do is the following. Because your implementation of DOM Builder is somewhat specific to your design choices, you need to be able to distinguish among your different node types. And if the current node, for instance, is a text node, then you can safely punt the matter of serialization to that content handler, or rather to that serializer, which is someone else's code, and just print out those characters. If instead you have an element node, well, just call that guy's start element routine, but then you have to actually walk over your children, because that might be somewhat implementation specific. So in short, we've just inserted a middleman between the process of walking your DOM and actually spitting it out to standard output. And because this middle piece, the DOM walker code, is the only piece of code that understands your particular implementation of the DOM. That was a lot of words, and if you've never looked at this file before, it's okay if this isn't quite clear. I think you'll find once you've implemented the first part of the project, which is the stuff we discussed last week, then you proceed to implement DOM Builder, and with it to enhance like the element class, which will be necessary, perhaps among others, the last step really is this DOM walker code. And perhaps take it on faith that it will be relatively straightforward once you've implemented the rest. And in fact, the only aspect that you have to deal with in this walker is the attribute support. It does work out of the box. But it's your attributes, again, design specific to your choices. Yeah?
So we're in effect implementing this by spitting out these simplified SACS interface events?
DOM Walker is calling the appropriate SACS events once it has pulled out of your DOM the appropriate content to pass to that. I'm sorry? It's like a SACS handler that's using another SACS handler to do most of the work, but you as the middleman are sort of walking your specific implementation of attributes. And again, we could have done this in different ways, but because our interface is simplified versus the standard one, we kind of had to write some of our own code to actually make use of that serializer. So, in fact, what's going to have to change here? Well, as the comment suggests, this part works, but you're going to need to pass in the appropriate object here, which is going to be one of those attributes objects, inside of which is going to be all of your attributes. You can do it any way you want, but what you have to pass here is a reference to an attributes object. Per the API. And so you could store it yourself as an attributes object, though that does, again, sort of violate the division between the DOM and SACS APIs. So it would be more proper, if inefficient, to have your own structure, whether it's a hash table or your own linked list, and then to copy it into this structure, or at least expose your structure with a attributes API as well. Like your class could just implement the attributes interface. And again, there is much more code that you've been handed than you actually have to write. Implementing support for attributes in XML parser.java, for instance, takes relatively few lines of code. You have to be careful so you get it right, but it's not a lot of code. More important is to understand the process and understand how all this stuff fits together, SACS and DOM and so forth. Other questions? Yeah?
Is it okay to reformat and significant white space, like you mentioned earlier in class, the space between an element and an attribute name?
Yep, sure. No, you do not have to preserve any insignificant white space, and insignificant white space includes the stuff between the angle brackets. I would say from a design perspective that it would be lazy programming, sort of, you know, one of those places where we can say, -1, if you are in fact printing out things that are just, you know, unnecessarily ugly, or, you know, maybe this is bar equals 1, but then you have this space at the end, just because it was easier to do that than to insert the, you know, one line if condition that fixes that. So I would be attentive to those kinds of issues, but if you want to throw a white space away, that's usually fine. But I wouldn't add it just because it's easier to code.
What about preserving the types of quotes that are used?
That is not important, really. Be sort of weird to change it on the user, but, I mean, double quotes are more common than single quotes, I would say, so it would be a little weird to go with single quotes all around, but it would not be incorrect. But, with that said, it would be incorrect if you do not check the value of the attribute, because if the original input is double quotes and there's some single quotes in there, you can't change yours to single quotes. You'll make the document non-well-formed.
Plus, you wouldn't be able to feed it into anything else if you changed doubles to singles, could you?
Well, you could. Single quotes are allowed around attribute values. But there's that whole notion of symmetry. The only way you can embed a single quote is to encase it in double quotes or vice versa. So if you change it, then it's problematic. However, with that said, that is not a detail that we emphasize in the project. So if you just use double quotes, even though that will break on inputs that use single quotes around double quotes, that's fine. But it would not be hard with a single call to, you know, do a substring check. You know, is there a single quote in here? And then you could decide what kinds of quotes to use.
So this partial supports and needs to support a single quote within a value?
Does it need to support single quotes in a value? Yes. It is a reasonable assumption, just to assume for simplicity, that the attributes will be double quoted. Or even if they're single quoted, you can output double quotes. But that's sort of a fun twist to add to the project, perhaps for the future. But again, it would not be hard, because you just look at the attribute's value. You do a substr call and say, does this thing have a single quote in it? If not, go ahead and use whatever you want. If it does, use what was ever there. And actually, you don't know what was there, so you'd have to then, you know, spit out double quotes arbitrarily. Other questions?
How do you know which classes have factory? You know, where do you use factories? Is that just where the API commands?
It's really just in the parsers that you'll see that particular approach.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
and sorry. The question was, where else might you see the factory interface? Just where we have this on. The answer is really just in the instantiation of the parsers. Sorry.
I remember when we were talking about when we find the attributes and put them into like a list.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put all the attributes into, push them onto like a list, then doesn't it make it harder to check to see if you have two attributes with the same name?
Good question. So if you are just pushing attributes onto a list, is it not hard to distinguish if there is one of the same name? So you're talking about in the DOM code then?
Or just in general, I guess. Like, wouldn't it just be more expensive to have each time you find a new attribute that you have to traverse the linked list to make sure that there isn't one of the same name?
Yes. No, that is a good... That is a good point, actually, because our elements class, so the question is, it seems dangerous using a linked list, for instance, to store the, actually, no, okay, I take this back. So the question is it dangerous to use a list, as I've just often been promoting verbally, for your implementation of attributes to just string them across an element laterally, because then you can't necessarily guarantee that they will be unique. So one response to that is that, yes, because then you would have to traverse the list to see if one is actually there. However, we are not writing a validating parser. There is no requirement that you check if a document not only is... Well, that's well-formedness. Another good tidbit to add to the parser. This is why it's a simplification. It would be invalid if it had... Well, you could. It's just inefficient because it's linear as opposed to constant time lookup. So the short answer is a hash table would be a better implementation of the attributes and probably the way that most implementations do it. It would be an error of well-formedness if you had two attributes of the same name, which means a parser should throw an error. This is not something that we've focused on, though, so you can assume that you don't need to do that, but a hash table or a hash map or any of those kinds of structures is the best approach.
You could actually keep the linked list and then keep this little hash thing on the side, too.
You could, but that'd be space redundant, right, because you could just store all the actual data in the hash table.
Yeah.
And that would facilitate, in the real API, calls like get attribute, which is a lookup by name. It'd be much quicker anyway.
So we're going to assume that there aren't duplicate names?
Correct. This is not something you have to check for. But you're adding to quite the laundry list of things we could be checking for. It's a good question. When in doubt, I mean, the spec is written as carefully as possible so that unless you are told to do something, like I'm not going to go try looking for crazy corner cases if it hasn't been so much as mentioned. But duplicate, let me just make a note to myself. Okay. Other questions? Any logistical issues with setting up on NICE or on your own machines?
No? Is it different when you SSH to NICE.FAS than it is to just SSH to NICE.Harvard? Is that always just SSH to NICE.Harvard?
That's fine. I think, in fact, no, they refer to the same. So NICE.Harvard's canonical name, it must be a name. This is probably an A name for this, nice.fas.harvard.edu. They're the same.
I'm a little bit confused about the distinction between the Xerces, the latest version of the... What all that is going on with the endorsed business and the latest version of Xerces and what's in the Java SDK itself.
Okay.
And especially as it concerns my Macintosh.
Sure. And are you on OS X 10 or?
Yes.
Okay. Or 10 point what?
10.4.
Okay. So you have Java 1.4 but can install 1.5, I believe, right?
Right.
Okay. So one thing you can do, I'll demonstrate this. Will break this. Any students currently trying to do their work, this will break temporarily, but I think it's low probability. So so on NICE, and this is not pat directories you need to look at because it's all behind the scenes to you, but we have the JRE, lib directory, and then endorsed. And in there are these four jars, three of which you were instructed to put in there for this project. If I temporarily move this directory endorsed elsewhere, just rename it so it can't be found. There's a command that I think I put in the spec called environment check. So an environment check is just an alias for... on the wrong machine. Okay, so environment check is an alias for this. It's a little helper utility that comes with Xalen. So actually, this won't work for you all yet until Project 2, when we advise you to install Xalen into the directory as well. But for now, if I run environment check, it tells me a whole bunch of stuff. But useful in it is that it tells you what version of Xerces is currently installed. The version that ships with JDK 1.4.2, at least for Linux, and I'm guessing for Mac, Apple, I don't know if they use Sun's code, do they, for the JDK? Okay, so it'd be interesting to see what the output of this program is for you. But Xerces in the Windows and in the Linux implementation of the JDK 1.4.2 ships with Xerces 2.4.1 and Xalen 2.4.0 and 2.4.1, which are three versions back. So as soon as I install the endorsed directory as you're advised, what happens, as you might guess, system is slow lately. What happens then is that it automatically now gets upgraded to Xalen 2.7.0 and Xerces 2.7.1, and also because of other stuff I've done, and you'll eventually do, ANT is upgraded to the latest version, and a few other things.
We have a PC, should we just copy what's in there into our...
You can. I mean, that's what I do on my own machines. I don't download and install Xerces and Xalen all the time. I steal the jars from the FAS system. It's fine to do that. The reason I don't promote that in the literature is because then students exit the course, and without E259's directory to FTP to, they don't know what they should be doing on their own. Right? You can steal these jars, but it's a useful exercise for a lot of people to know where they came from. That's all. So, in short, the JDK from Sun ships with Xerxes and Xalin pre-installed, and they implement together the JAXP interface, which is now part of the Java 2 second edition API. By adding this endorse directory, the JDK by default looks the search path. The high priority of the endorse directory is higher than class path and higher than other locations, and so they override the built-in implementations. Simply adding it to your class path is like adding it to the end of the search path, which means it would never get overridden. So the cleanest way of doing this is actually this endorsed method. And if you Google Java endorsed overrides mechanism, you'll see a little FAQ about it.
Yeah, and I'll have to play around with this a little bit because things are organized a little bit differently on
the map. Okay, email me if you have questions, but we've had many students, including past teaching fellows, do it on macOS without ever having trouble. So
I found one thing that looks like it's the right thing, but I'll see if it actually works.
Okay, just drop me a note if not, because it'd be interesting to tease apart. It could be OS X 10.4 is a little different now than we've seen in the past for Java. Other questions?
I have a little question.
Sure. Okay.
We did this to set up on...
Okay.
Yeah. And what I ended up with was a directory named CSCIE259, not the project directory. And so I don't know what the intent was there.
It sounds like you did not execute this first. Because what this will do if this directory does not exist is call it that. But if it does exist, it will put that in there.
Okay.
So maybe it was a typo or something, but that would explain why that happened.
Okay.
It was.
So does this end up in your
home directory? Yes.
Home directory.
So maybe I would conjecture you either didn't execute that command or there's a typo in one of the two lines that you typed.
Right.
And so that's why that happened. Other questions? Okay, so why don't we officially adjourn here, but I will stick around right here if you have more private or embarrassing questions.